නමෝ තස්ස භගවතු අරහතෝ සම්මා සම්බුද්දස්ස නමෝ තස්ස භගවතු අරහතෝ සම්මා සම්බුද්දස්ස නමෝ තස්ස භගවතු අරහතෝ සම්මා සම්බුද්දස්ස අපාරෝතාතේ සංගමතස්ස ද්වාරා යේසෝතවන්තෝ පමුංචන්තු සදහන්ති So everybody in this room, we're all sitting down here together, breathing. At least those of us who aren't either dead or in fourth jhana are breathing, so it probably includes most of us. And since we've been here together for some time in this room, then it's probably safe to say that some of the breath that I've breathed out, you've breathed in. And some of the breath that you've breathed out, I've breathed in. And we've probably shared our breath with every person in this room by now. Which in one sense is a bit icky, isn't it? And it's not just breathing, but when we breathe those things in, it becomes part of who we are. Right? Breath just doesn't go in and out. It goes in and becomes part of our metabolism, part of our brains. Right? The oxygen goes and powers our brains, powers our hearts, powers everything that we're doing. So a little bit of you has become a bit of me. And a bit of me has become a bit of you, and the same for everybody here. We like to think of ourselves as individuals, as persons, right? I'm me. You're you. See, I know I'm me, it says so on my passport. But actually these things are just changing all the time. There's no you. What you are right now is different from what you were 5 minutes ago. You feel different. Your emotions have changed. Your thoughts have changed. Your posture's changed. And I'm sure that for all of you, if you were to think, if you weren't here this evening in the Buddhist Society, you know, if you're doing something else this evening, what would your thoughts be? What would your mood be? What would your consciousness be? Right? Probably be something quite different. Being here in this place with these people, it changes. Your mind changes your consciousness. And for myself as well, here I am sitting on this chair in front of these glaring lights. I'm looking out as if I can actually see people out there, but actually all I can see is glare and some vague shapes. If I wasn't here tonight, then I'd be at my little hut in Bodhnyana. So who we are, it's constantly changing because of who we're with, where we are, what we're doing. And it's not just the other people, but it's our whole context, our whole environment. Actually, in Western sort of language and thought, we have this concept we call the environment, which basically means the things around us that isn't people or isn't artificial stuff. But that concept doesn't really exist in Buddhism. We just have Dhamma. There's no idea of a separate, you know, the idea of humanity as being something separate from the environment doesn't exist. And so we breathe in, we breathe out. We're part of the environment. You're breathing in oxygen, breathing out carbon dioxide. You are creating the greenhouse effect just by breathing. You are contributing to global warming just by breathing. If you really want to think, I want to be environmentally conscious and not contribute to global warming, then stop breathing. Do breath meditation. Get into fourth jhana, no breathing. Easy. So all of our lives, everything we do, every step we take, every thought, every breath, all of this is dependent on, part of, interconnected with a wider context, a wider environment. I wanted to use this opportunity this evening to talk a little bit about this and about how these notions of being interconnected with the environment play out in both in Buddhism, in the Dhamma, but also in the current context where we're facing great challenges through climate change. Of course, there are many other challenges we face, but that one is, I think, the biggest one. I found I was planning to do a talk this evening on climate change in Buddhism, and I was dismayed to find out a day or two ago that Ajahn Brahm gave a talk on the same topic a couple of weeks ago. So I asked him about it this morning, and he said, "Oh, don't worry, just give another one. They'll have forgotten anyway." He's like, I said, "What did you talk about?" He said, "Oh, I can't remember. What was it?" No, he could remember a few things. He's not quite that bad. I am. I'll completely forget afterwards. But anyway, so hopefully we don't bore you by talking about the same topic again and again, but I believe it's worth talking about again and again. I believe that it is, as Kevin Rudd said a few years ago, the great moral challenge of our time, a moral challenge which Kevin Rudd failed to meet rather spectacularly, and which I believe most of our leaders and the people who should be responding to have not been responding to as they should have. I mean, it's not my place here to talk in too much detail about the science and so on, and nor do I want to focus too much on practical questions of what we can do. I think these things are discussed ably in many places. But there are a couple of things which I want to talk about which perhaps are not so commonly addressed or well understood. The first thing being, what's the relationship or connection between environmental thought generally and climate change specifically? And Buddhism and the Dhamma. And the second thing is, how do we deal with it? How do we deal with the emotions? It's a very emotional topic. there's a great potential for depression, for despair. I know I met some Buddhist monastics in the US about, I think it was about 5 years ago now, and they were saying they were already starting to see people who were getting depression from climate change, fear of the future. So this is something I think that we need to take quite seriously and to look at carefully. It will become more and more important. I started out the talk tonight talking about breathing and about how our breath connects us with the environment from moment to moment. Of course, this is something that as meditators we experience in a profound and direct way. Your breath is with you every moment of your life, from the time that you emerge from your mother's womb until the time that you pass away. There's just this thin sort of safety net the breath provides us with. And just a few breaths, if we miss out, we're starting to struggle. A few more, a minute or two without breathing, we're starting to fall unconscious or even to die. This is how closely and directly, how immediately we're connected. This is not something which is vague or theoretical. It's not just an abstraction. It's a living reality we experience every moment of every day. And one which, as when we meditate, we see at a far more profound level. And this breath that we're breathing, just as in this room, we're breathing in what comes from all the people around us, right? And the same thing's happening with the environment. We're constantly breathing in the air which has been affected by human activity, by global warming. There was a book published a few years ago, I can't remember the author name, but I think it was called The End of Nature. And he argued, I think quite correctly, that there's no real such thing as nature anymore, conceived as being separate from human activity. No matter where you go, whether it's to the Antarctica or to the bottom of the oceans, to the top of the Himalayas, you can find particles that are from chemicals from factories or some evidence of human activity. Everywhere you go, it can't be escaped. And so every breath that we're taking is connected with climate change. Every breath that you take from now until you die is changed. It's different to how it would have been. You know, you still find these arguments in the papers and so on when there's a storm recently came from Europe, where I was on the last flight from Hamburg to Saarbrücken. And by the way, if there's anybody from the retreat in Germany who's watching this, hi, how are you going? A few people came to the retreat who had seen the talks on YouTube and things, so anyway. And I was on the last flight. The subsequent flights were cancelled because of a massive storm that was in Europe at the time. It nearly breached the dam control and flood control. Everywhere you go, you see signs of these things happening. There's nowhere that you can escape. And yet we still find people questioning this. Oh, was this really because of climate change and so on? And our beloved Minister for the Environment will happily say, oh, it's not climate change because Wikipedia says so. I'm actually part of an interfaith group on climate change that goes to Canberra and talks to the government and so on from time to time, and we're planning to go back there in a couple of months, and I'm already steeling myself to, when I talk to Greg Hunt, to not mention Wikipedia. It's going to be difficult, but I'm just going to have to make myself do it. This is ridiculous. Of course it's to do with climate change. Everything is to do with climate change. That's what the climate is. The climate is everything. It's everything which is all around us every day, all the time. Every breath that you take, everything you look at, everything you see is affected by climate change. Every leaf on every tree, every bird in the sky, every drop of rain that falls, none of it is unaffected by human activity. We live in this intimate and absolute relationship with everything around us. There's no distinction. The idea that I'm separate from the environment is purely just an abstraction. Actually, it's just ego. In Indian terminology, they use the word ahankara, mean I-making. Right? So we make this I, we make this identity, which is separate from the environment. Actually, this is just delusion. Everything is just part of it. There's a wonderful story in the Buddhist suttas which talks about the environment and our relationship with the environment. It's called the Aganya Sutta. It's in the Digha Nikaya. And the Aganya Sutta is kind of a myth or a fable which tells the story of the origin of the world and the evolution of society, of humanity, of nature, and so on. Very interesting sutta and very well worth having a look. There's a few suttas that deal with this kind of thing, but this is the most important one. And as a Buddhist story of creation, most creation mythologies start out by saying, in the beginning, right? That's a sort of standard beginning for a creation myth, in the beginning. Whereas a Buddhist creation myth starts out, there comes a time when the world ends. Right? Isn't that fantastic? That's how you begin a creation myth. There comes a time when the world ends. Yeah, because in Buddhism there's no absolute creation, no absolute idea of a beginning of things. So things go through cycles. The world ends. It happens. Deal with it. Later on the world evolves again. And it gives quite a detailed explanation or description of this process of evolution. And what's remarkable about the process of evolution is that the sentient beings, if you like, the people who are there, evolve together with the environment. It's because of the choices that people make that the environment evolves and grows. So, for example, initially, again, according to this mythology, the people are like spirits. There's no humans as such, but there's beings of light who move through the air feeding on joy, bhidibhaka. It's a kind of lovely idea that the earth is this kind of ocean, right? It's formless ocean, and then there's just these beings of light moving above them. Until on the ocean there appears this kind of what they call patavi rasa, or rasa patavi, which is kind of described as being like sweet milk, like condensed milk, maybe. Ajahn Brahm's favorite, condensed milk on the surface of the earth, I don't know. Anyway, and one of them thinks, oh, that looks nice, and they taste it. And because they get greedy, they eat it all up, their bodies become solid and they become hard, and the earth starts to evolve again. The cycles appear, the days and nights appear, vegetation appears and evolves, and it goes through this whole cycle of different kinds of vegetation that the beings would eat, from like fungi and mushrooms to creepers and then to grains and so on and so forth. And each time the environment changes, the cycles of the seasons change, the plants around change as the people change. Right? They're not separate things. They're constantly moving together. And in all of those changes, the driving force is greed. Yeah? Is greed, lack of contentment. Until eventually the beings start to divide the land up, right? Rather than saying, actually nature is bountiful. Nature is incredible. Yeah? You look everywhere you go, it's just unbelievable. You just go, even in cracks in buildings, plants will find a life and will grow. I mean, you can't stop it. right? You can't stop nature from growing. You can't stop plants from growing. Everywhere they are. And yet, because of our greed, there's not enough. And so because of this, then, beings started disputing about who's going to get enough to eat and so on, so they began dividing the land up. Yeah, this is mine and this is yours. Right? How can we do this? This is craziness. This is one of the things that the white people did when they came to Australia, you know. And the land had been lived here, the Aborigines had lived here for so many thousands of years. And then we come along and say, we own this. I'm going to draw a line saying this belongs to me and this doesn't. Get out. It's absolute craziness. What right do we have to go around saying we own the land? And so once you've done that, then of course the next stage, then people transgress that. As soon as you draw a line and say don't cross the line, then somebody's going to cross it. Right? So then you've got crime, you've got punishment, you've got lies and all of those kinds of things. And so this process is all driven by greed. And that process is still going on. And in fact, it's going on even more acutely today than it has ever in human history. The amount of greed and the harm that that greed produces is greater than ever. And the statistic came out in the paper just a couple of days ago that we all know that about the inequality in the world, but the latest statistic was that the 85 richest people in the world have as much wealth as the 3.5 billion poorest people in the world. Yeah? Let me repeat that. The 85 million richest have as much wealth as the 3.5 billion poorest. That's not million, that's billion. And that's that greed. And that's the greed which is destroying us. What's crazy about these things, and one of the craziest things about this whole process is, who does it benefit? Who actually wins? Right? Of course, nobody wins. People might think they win for a little while. Right? I was talking with my mother and my stepfather about this a few years ago. And my stepfather was 80 something at the time, and I was kind of half joking with him and said that, you know, you guys have ruined the planet for us and now we have to live with it, you know. And he said, well, what can I do? You know, we'll be gone soon. I said, oh, don't you worry, you'll be back. Right? So it's become quite a commonplace to think, well, look, the climate, the things that we're doing now to the environment will be things that our children and our grandchildren, right, we'll have to live with, we'll have to deal with, right? But if we believe in rebirth, then it's the things that we're going to have to deal with. Yeah? We're going to be back here. We're going to have to live here. What kind of planet are we going to have? And so if this idea that greed is this driving force, then the solution surely should be fairly obvious, right? I was when I was in Vienna recently, I was at an interfaith conference and there was a panel talking about climate change. Because it's an interfaith conference, people come from all different kind of backgrounds, right? And anyway, there was this one fellow who was talking at the conference. I had never met him before. And he sort of reached this point in his talk and he was saying that we're going to have to start considering the idea of, and he could see he hesitated, and then he said, Nekama. And so those of you who know a little bit of Pali will know Nekama means renunciation. And, of course, from that I knew that he was a Buddhist. I spoke to him afterwards and turned out, of course, he was a Buddhist. But so this idea of Nekama or renunciation is starting to actually be spoken. It's very kind of taboo idea, isn't it, right? It's a very counter idea, very revolutionary, really. You know, this, the amount of messages we have to consume, to have, to get, to want, right? These are huge and like we've been pummeled by these things through media, advertisements, all of these things all the time. And the message to let go, the message enough, the message that actually we can be happy with very little. You know, I was born in Perth. I grew up in a reasonably well-off middle-class family in Perth. And I never really lacked for anything, you know. And when I went to Thailand and became a monk, it was the first time that I'd seen real poverty. Even though poverty in Thailand, for the most part, isn't that kind of, you know, isn't all that bad. I mean, people usually have enough to eat and so on. And I was out in the villages, and you could see the villages were, you know, quite poor. But they were reasonably comfortable and reasonably well off. And when I was living in forest monasteries, I remember being in the monastery in Phuthomkom, is on the very easternmost tip of Thailand, right on the overlooking the Mekong River. And the huts that we had there were very, very simple. And they're just made out of grass roof, bamboo walls. They're just materials which are taken from the immediate environment. And, you know, if you leave it for a couple of years, it'll just go back to the earth. And the place is so simple. It's even, you know, compared with the poor people living in those villages, was even much, much simpler than that. And I remember one day sitting in this little hut and thinking, you know, looking around at all the things that I had there. I had, you know, my set of robes. I had one of those roll-out straw mats to lie on, a steel cup, a couple of candles, matches, razor blade. Trying to think what else. Not much else. That was about it. Toothbrush, thank you. Toothbrush and toothpaste. Probably some soap somewhere. And then, you know, I just sat there and looked at all these things and thought, what do I want? What could actually make me happier? And I couldn't think of anything. You know, I had no idea. What could I actually have that would make me happier? I couldn't think of anything. So the amount of things that we have compared to the amount of things that we need is just ridiculous. It's completely obscene. And we need to really start thinking seriously, what can we do to let go, to practice some renunciation? You know, oh yeah.
Could you pass my bag?
When I arrived in Vienna, and I got off the plane and I just had, this was my only luggage, and they said, you know, are you going to pick up any more luggage? I said no, and I said this is all I've got, right? So it was my bag. It was a bit fuller than this one is, right? It's the same bag, but it was more full. And they said, you travel with that as your only luggage. How can you do that? And I said, no, you don't understand. What I have in this bag is not my luggage. What I have in this bag is everything I own in the entire world. Right? 47 years I've been alive, and that's all I've got to show for it. It's kind of sad, isn't it? That's enough. And honestly, half the things in there I didn't really need. So when are we going to actually start to really take this on board and think, actually, we don't need all of this stuff? This is how are we going to start to let go? You know, so many times when I'm trying to talk about these things, people say to me, oh, attachments are so strong. Oh, letting go is so hard. Oh. And I say, letting go is easy. They say, no, letting go is so hard. They say, no, letting go is easy. They say, how do you begin to practice letting go? I said, okay, here's how. If you want to start out with letting go, here's what you do. Okay? You have to start from the beginning. First, you quit your job. Second, give away your home. Thirdly, say goodbye to your family. And fourthly, just walk down the road with nothing. See, it's easy. It only takes 5 minutes. What's your problem? Letting go is easy. We all think letting go is so hard, you know? Not only is letting go easy, but I can prove it to you. Right? Letting go is easier than holding on. I can prove to you it's a biological fact. Okay? Now, if I'm holding onto this glass, okay, I have to use muscles to hold onto that, right? Now, one thing I learned in biology in high school was that you have basically two kinds of muscles in your body, right? So in your hand you have a set of muscles to hold on and a set of muscles to let go, right? One set of muscles to hold on, one to let go. The technical term is the holder on muscles and the letter go muscles, right? And which one's stronger? Right? The holding on muscles are strong, right? The letting go muscles are weak. Why is that? Because holding on is hard. Yes? If holding on was easy, you wouldn't need strong muscles to do it. Yeah? Holding on is hard. You have to work at it. You have to constantly make it happen. Letting go is easy. Nothing to it. And you all know that. Holding on to your jobs. It's hard, isn't it? You have to work every day. Holding on to your family. Holding on to your car, your possessions, your home, all of these things. It's so much hard work. And sometimes we don't even answer the question, what would happen if I didn't? What would happen if I let go? I think we're moving to a stage in our development as a human society where these questions are no longer merely a matter of spiritual choice. I think it's becoming a matter of survival. I think that it's not going to be very long before we're going to be facing up to the fact that we either make these choices to let go, to be content, to live with much less than we were used to have the idea that our children will live in smaller homes with smaller cars, if they have homes. I think this is going to be forced upon us. I don't think we're going to have any choice in that. What I think we do have a choice in is the choice of how do we respond to that? How do we deal with that? Do we go down gracelessly, kicking and screaming, denying the reality, trying to hold on to a way of life and a set of values which have demonstrably failed us and resulted in destruction? Or are we going to see it as an opportunity to really start living in accordance with our values? And I know, I've talked to so many people about this, and I know that most people have this feeling of, well, they know that something's out of balance. Know that they would like to live in a different kind of way. but they don't know how it's possible. So part of this involves individual choices. Right? So part of it involves each of us looking into our life and thinking, what are we going to do to make things better? Right? And so, of course, there are many things that we can do. We can change our light globes to low-energy light globes. That's terrific. It will make no difference, but it will make you feel better. Sorry to say. We can all buy hybrids and electric cars. That will also make no difference, but it will make you feel better, so that's nice. Just in case you think I'm being unduly pessimistic on that, there was a study that came out a couple of days ago that actually showed that clearly that there actually is almost no real difference whether you buy an electric or hybrid car or an ordinary car, ultimately on the environment. So a lot of these kinds of individual choices which we're being asked to make and so on, to be honest, I think are a bit of a smokescreen. I think they're kind of avoidance tactics. The real changes that we have to make are changes that are going to be much more fundamental and which aren't just going to be these kind of surface changes, but are going to be things which we will have to do as a society, working together. Changing what we, for example, changing what we mean to have a house. What kind of dwellings we live in. Changing the way that we eat. And one of the great unspoken contributors to global warming is meat consumption. It consumes a vast quantity of energy and emits vast quantities of carbon dioxide. So there are many of these kinds of choices which we're going to have to make and changes which we're going to have to make. Why aren't people making these kinds of changes? I think there are many reasons, but I think one of the underlying problems is that it's very hard for us to actually face up to realities. We don't want to know. I still feel this. I still find it difficult to think about and difficult to talk about it, even when I'm talking with other people who are deeply committed and working in the field to try to work with climate change. There's still, I find it constantly, a reluctance to admit how serious things are and what is the depth of the change that's going to be required. If you don't feel depressed, then, in my opinion, if you don't get depressed sometimes, then you're not familiar with the facts. The facts are depressing. And I don't think, you know, as Buddhists or people interested in the Buddhist path, we start out with dukkha, start out with understanding of suffering. And we shouldn't shy away from an acknowledgement of the reality of things. So this, I think, is something that we should help each other with as a community and start looking and thinking about ways as a community to support each other through this. There are going to be changes in the future. There already are changes right now. I don't need to convince you of this. You've been sweating for the last how many weeks in Perth, how many bushfires and so on, the fourth hottest year in history, and incidentally, little reported detail, but this year, if it wasn't for the effect of climate change, this year should have been one of the coolest years in recent history in terms of solar activity, El Nino and other effects. And what we've been experiencing here in Perth in the last couple of weeks is nothing. Right? Last year about a year ago, I was in Sydney when we had the day when it was 47 degrees. at that type of temperature, the train lines start to buckle, the fruit bats drop dead out of the trees in their thousands. And these are conditions that are already happening around us, and they'll continue to happen and get much, much worse. So I think this is something that we need to not be afraid to talk about with each other. Not be afraid to face up to the reality, and not be afraid to discuss meaningful and important changes that we need to make. Changes that will be not only for our own benefit, but changes for the benefit for all of humanity, all of the planet. From a Buddhist point of view, you know, I think that there are profound and important aspects within Buddhist philosophy for addressing this, understanding it and dealing with it. Of course, the notion of impermanence is fundamental to Buddhism. Everything is changing. The notice of conditionality, the idea of conditionality is fundamental to Buddhism. Things are evolving and changing by causes and conditions. The idea that these causes and conditions are being driven by choices, being driven especially by the choices based on greed, this is also fundamental to Buddhist philosophy. Also fundamental to Buddhist philosophy is the idea that we find happiness by letting go of that greed, by finding contentment. So these are already there, those ideas are there, they're part of the basis of what this teaching is that we're practicing. Just like every generation before us who's trying to practice the Dhamma, then we have to answer this question of how do we apply the Dhamma, how do we realize it here and now. And so while that context of understanding in the context of the climate change and the shifts in the environment is something that's new, or at least newly urgent in our age, in many ways what we're doing is no different. This is just humanity. Humanity has always been like this, birth, aging and death. So I don't have any particular answers in terms of how do we stop things or how do we change things. I'm very much struggling with this. I'm also struggling with the idea of how I can cope with it, of how to articulate these ideas, how to get people to... I'm not so much interested in activism and making people change. I'm much more interested in making people reflect. You can figure out what you want to do by yourself. Right? You don't need me to tell you that. But if anything that we can learn from Buddhism and from the Dhamma is how we exist as part of a greater reality, how we constantly exist in this absolute and intimate sense of interdependence with everything going on around us, so that every breath for the rest of our lives is climate change. Every breath is somebody else's. Every time that we breathe in and breathe out, we're breaking down the boundaries that we've placed around ourselves. So anyway, that's my talk for you this evening on Buddhism and Dhamma and climate change. I offer this for your reflection and for your depression. And if anybody has any questions or comments, then they're invited. Thanks, Christina.
Oh, sorry. It's more of a comment than a question. I hope I don't go on a little bit too long. But one of the things that I feel puts a lot of pressure on people to consume a lot more than what they need is actually striving for status and kind of recognition that you are a successful person, and that if you live in a fairly modest sort of material way, which I do, mainly not just because of climate change, but I've always lived in quite a small house just because I like to work part-time and things like that. And before I retired recently, I used to be a doctor, and I would have things like the postman saying to me, "What, you're a doctor, you should be driving a Mercedes." And I had little Datsun 120Y at that stage. And there's part of me that's thinking, oh, people will think there's something wrong with me. They'll think I'm not very good. They'll think I've been struck off, or, you know, and kind of feeling a certain pressure, which I know as a Buddhist it's not about what other people think, but I think for a lot of people that is a really big pressure, wanting to appear to be successful.
Sure, I think that's a big part of it, that whole kind of status thing. So the basic solution to that is to just get in your 120Y and drive around Peppermint Grove and just feel morally superior to everybody. Yeah. Okay. Any other questions? Okay, a few from Tim from the USA. How's it going, Tim? Hi. How does one deal with people who have no religion, worship only money, and use violence or force to get whatever they want? Well, yeah. Well, I think that first of all, I'd say that there's an interesting and perhaps somewhat unfortunate group of ideas there, a group of ideas that I don't necessarily put together, and that is the collation of, say, people who have no religion with those who worship only money and use violence or force to get whatever they want. In my experience, people who have no religion are often far more moral and more have a better sense of values than people who have religion. That obviously that's not always the case, but in my experience it often is. I was discussing this just a couple of weeks ago with Thea Omerod, who's the chair of our interfaith group on climate change. And she'd just been up at Maules Creek with the protesters there, and she was saying that all of these young people who are they're not religious. They're up there to, you know, many of them atheists or secularists or whatever, and religion isn't a big part of their life. But Thea is a Catholic, and she was saying that they're the real Christians. They're living the life that Jesus would have lived, and they're living a far more Christian life than we are living in our comfortable homes and regarding ourselves as being Christians. So perhaps what the question really meant was perhaps something like people who have no values or something like that. Anyway, people who worship only money, use violence or force to get whatever they want. I mean, this is one of the drawbacks of Buddhism, actually, because Buddhism's also a bit nice, isn't it? You know, so we don't like to, you know, or would you please stop, you know? You know, like, I appreciate that, you know, your suffering is causing you to, you know, blow things up and murder people and stuff, but, you know, it's not very skillful to respond to that. We face this issue even within the Sangha, because the monastic communities have a code of discipline and so on, but it's very gentle, and it's very much dependent on the sincerity. So if somebody just doesn't want to admit that they've done something wrong, then it's very hard to do anything about it. It's very hard unless somebody wants to improve. So if that kind of approach struggles within a monastic environment, it's even more difficult to apply in a worldly environment, when obviously there are many people who just aren't interested to do the right thing. So as the general principle, I would say, from a Buddhist point of view, is that in some cases, we need to protect society, right? But we should think in terms of protection rather than punishment. So, you know, if somebody's violent or something like that, so sometimes violent people need to be locked up and you need to keep them away so that they're not going to hurt people. But you don't do that because you're going to punish them. You do it just for the sake of safety. And if, that person changes and they're not going to be a danger to people anymore, then, you know, you can let them out. And I think that there are a lot of good models for how to do this. And there's some quite successful approaches in places like Norway and Sweden in incarceration practices, which have been very successful. Okay. So Alex from Melbourne. Hi, Alex. How are you going? Why do we have to live in smaller homes, smaller car, and consume less? Why not look at the other side of the equation, like overpopulation? Overpopulation is an issue, but as I just mentioned before, there's the 85 richest people in the world have as much money as the 3.5 billion poorest people. Now, the amount of money you have isn't directly correlated with the amount of environmental damage you make, but there's a pretty strong correlation there. The reality is that the vast amount of damage to the environment is caused by rich people, and that in rich countries like Australia, we essentially outsource our pollution and destruction of the environment to third world countries. We don't completely do that. I mean, we do a fairly good job of trashing much of our own environment, but a lot of it is outsourced to China, right? And the smog that you see in Chinese skies, you know, some of that is because you like to get cheap gadgets and you prefer to outsource your smog to Beijing and to Africa and various other places. Overpopulation, well, if you want to solve the world's overpopulation problem, good luck with that. Yeah. What seems to be the case is that, as societies get sort of above the poverty line, and as there seems to be a reasonable amount of education and so on in societies, that population growth kind of naturally drops off. I'm not convinced that population growth as such is such a big problem, but it's much more to do with the amount of consumption that people do. If consumption is moderate and sustainable, then the Earth is a broad place and can sustain a lot of people. Scott from Sydney. Hello, Scott. It seems to me that the dissatisfaction with the state of the world is no very Buddhist, I probably mean not very Buddhist. Ajahn Brahm repeatedly advises dissatisfied people to accept the situation that they're in. How do these reconcile? Well, let's not mistake these things. To accept the situation, accept the reality of the situation, does not mean that you don't do anything about it. And one of the good illustrations of this was a story that Ajahn Brahm has told a number of times, and about his own experience within Thailand. And he made the difference between being a pacifist and being a passivist. And the difference was well brought out in his experience in Thailand in the late 1970s. And when he was travelling through, and there was these communist rebels living in the hills. And what happened was that there was a rebellion, a communist uprising, and when it was suppressed, all of the students and so on went out into the hills and started agitating among the villagers. And they began to tell the villagers that, the government doesn't care about you. They're all rich and stuff, and you don't have homes, you don't have electricity, you don't have water supplies, you don't have hospitals, you don't have schools, and you don't have roads. So what the government did at the time was that they, rather than hunting down the rebels, they contained them and mostly kept the thing low key. So they kept them where they were and they just left them be. But they, as well as just containing the situation, they then started listening to what the actual problems of the villagers were. And then they realized, well, actually, the villagers aren't being irrational or unreasonable. They want an education for their children, right? Maybe we should build some schools, right? They want a place to go to when they're sick. Maybe we should build some hospitals. And they actually began to build these things, and they put in roads, and they built health centers. These days, if you go around Thailand, there's sealed roads that go to pretty much every village. There's health centers not far from any place, and you can go and get decent health care. There's electricity to every village. There's telephones to every village. And so the government actually did all those things which the people wanted. And as a result of that, the rebels didn't get any traction. So eventually the government gave an amnesty and said to the rebels, you know, you can come in, lay down your guns, come in, and then you can come back and join society. And that's what actually happened. And they did. One of my friends in Thailand was one of those rebels. He's now a successful businessman in Chiang Mai, runs a number of guest houses and so on, still works in politics, still tries to get a fairer, better society there. Some of the former rebels even became members of parliament in Thailand. And so this is a great example of that difference between being a pacifist and a passivist, as Ajahn Brahm puts it. So pacifist meaning that they weren't killing or waging war, but they also weren't being just passive. They were working actively to overcome the problem. So if you just don't do anything to overcome the problem, then I'm afraid that you're part of it. Right? We are all contributing to it. We're all making it worse. This is why I said earlier, just by breathing out, you're adding carbon dioxide to the atmosphere. You are contributing to the greenhouse effect by being. So don't think that you're innocent, right? You are guilty. So we're all contributing to it. But what are we trying to do to help? Okay. So that's the three questions I have here. It's 9 o'clock now. I guess it's probably time we should be finishing up. So let's finish by paying respects to the Triple Gem.